ran against the grain. Busing, meant to desegregate schools in the North, Midwest, and West, was one of the hottest flashpoints of the 1970s. But does our national memory of the white backlash against busing obscure more than it illuminates? I'm Sasha Lilly. Historian Matthew Delmont joins me to reflect on the political implications of turning segregation in the North into the narrow issue of school transfers. That's coming right up. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. In the 1970s, after years of struggle by African American families to desegregate schools in northern cities, the court stepped in and ordered the transfer of black and white students between schools, what has become known as busing. But the crisis of school segregation was overshadowed by the so-called crisis of busing, which the media presented through the lens of the white families opposing it. Yet even at its peak in the 1970s, court-ordered busing applied to only 5% of public school students, something which Matthew Delmont explores in his book, Why Busing Failed: Race, Media, and the National Resistance to School Desegregation, published by the University of California Press. He teaches history at Arizona State University and joins me now. Matthew, in the media coverage of the time, and in most of the histories that have come down to us, busing has been portrayed as the rock against which the Northern civil rights movement foundered. Why do you argue, then, that busing is a red herring?
So I think the problem is that we tend to start the story of busing in the 1970s in Boston. But in fact, you have busing show up as an issue almost two decades earlier. So just after the Brown versus Board decision, you have civil rights activists in places like New York and other northern cities pushing their school officials to address northern school segregation. So when we start the story in the 1970s, we miss the fact that there's organized civil rights activism across the North that's calling attention to these issues. But we also miss the fact that there was organized resistance to civil rights and organized resistance to school segregation that starts in the 1950s in the North that uses the language of busing as a way to motivate and mobilize against school segregation. So by the late 1950s, you have white mothers in New York marching and using the language of busing to say that they don't want their kids sent to different schools or don't want any other black or Puerto Rican kids sent to white schools. And you see protests in cities like Boston, Chicago, Detroit by the early 1960s. So this story really starts almost two decades before the 1970s. And if we lose that history, we fail to understand how this language developed and why it resonated so powerfully with people who were against school segregation in the North.
Well, let's talk about that broader context historically. In 1954, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in Brown versus Board of Education that racial segregation in public schools was unconstitutional. How did patterns of school segregation differ in the North and the West than in the South?
The mechanisms by which schools became segregated outside of the South were more subtle. So the Brown versus Board decision only applied to schools in the South. What they had there was what was called de jure segregation, so segregation by law, where it was officially the case where you had white schools and black schools. In the North, Midwest, and West, you had percentages that looked quite similar to the South in terms of school segregation, but the mechanisms were different. It was often referred to as de facto segregation, but that's in some ways a misnomer because that implies that it was innocent in some way. And in fact, it wasn't innocent at all, that you had neighborhoods that were created based on segregated housing policies, segregated mortgage lending policies and public housing policies. And then you had school district lines, the zoning lines that followed those residential segregation patterns and also in some cases exacerbated those housing patterns. But those were very difficult for civil rights activists to prove because the northern school boards would consistently deny that they were intentionally taking steps to segregate their schools. So as a result, it was visible to anyone who looked that schools in Los Angeles, schools in Chicago, schools in New York were incredibly segregated. But it was very difficult to bring those cases to courts to be able to have them addressed.
So you're saying that this notion of de facto segregation ultimately proved to be a problem because it projected the idea that people of different races chose to live apart or study apart, hence, and that public policy, in effect, was not the culprit.
Exactly. And initially, that language of de facto is advocated by civil rights activists and lawyers as a way to put more pressure on the South. So they see the South as a more clear-cut case that they can bring to the Supreme Court and win that case. And so they're initially pushing for a different treatment of how they view segregation in the South and versus in the North. What ends up happening, though, is that language gets taken up, this language of de facto gets taken up by Northern politicians, Northern parents, Northern school officials, as a way to say, you know, what we have going on here, it's innocent. This is just a result of private decisions, of market forces, of where people are choosing to live, and that government has no role in this. Historians have now found in a number of cases all across the country that that idea of de facto is a myth, that, in fact, there were a series of both public and private decisions that created segregated neighborhoods and schools all across the country. And it was just incredibly difficult for civil rights activists and lawyers to win those cases because they had to find a tremendous amount of evidence and try to extract that evidence from often from school officials who are often very reluctant to provide sort of the detailed descriptions of why school zones were drawn the way they were.
So what were the differences in the way the law was applied to segregation in the South and in the North? And perhaps you could explain the concept of racial imbalance, a rather slippery term.
Sure. So after Brown versus Board, I think two things happen. In the South, you have what they call massive resistance. So school boards, politicians refusing to abide by the Supreme Court ruling. So for a good 10 years after 1954, very little actual integration happens in the South. In the North, civil rights activists recognize that this decision only applies to the South, but they're waiting for a similar type of decision to come to their cities because they recognize school segregation is there. For school officials, they're in some ways hoping that that kind of decision doesn't come to their schools. They recognize that there is what they end up calling racial imbalance. So that language of racial imbalance is a euphemism for school segregation because, again, they're looking for ways to describe the conditions of segregation. So the fact that you have schools that are over 90% African-American or schools are over 90% white, but they want to call it something different than segregation because segregation is what they're going to associate with the South. So they end up choosing this language of racial imbalance.
So to what degree were white children being bused in the North before the court stepped in around desegregation of schools?
Before you have the active protests against busing, you have school buses being used all across the country, and they're doing two things. They're helping it make it possible to have a more modern school district, so you have students being transported to larger high schools. But then at the same time, you have buses that often being used to transport white students past closer African-American schools to white schools and black students past nearer white schools to African-American schools. So busing is actually initially used in many cases to perpetuate school segregation. When they start making these both voluntary and court-ordered plans to try to integrate schools using busing, the first attempts at that are usually transporting African-American and Puerto Rican students to all-white schools, and then usually not transporting white children. So some of the first protests I found against busing are taking place in Queens in the late 1950s, for example. And there you had white mothers protesting a policy that was going to send 400 African-American and Puerto Rican students from a school in Brooklyn to a school in Queens. No white children were going to be bused there. It was going to be a one-way busing program, but still it provoked month-long protests among the white community.
So in effect, the rhetoric that was harnessed around busing by white parents, which was that their children were going to be sent out of their neighborhoods, far away, stuck on buses to integrate, in effect, all black schools, and the mantra that they wanted neighborhood schools, this became a real catchphrase, that was actually not even part of the picture in these early protests against busing, that the white students weren't being bused in the first place.
That's exactly right. So a lot of the protests that came out around busing were about a fear about what might happen in the future. So in New York, for example, where some of these busing protests start, you have rumors that they're going to be busing millions of kids all across the city, right? So from different boroughs, from Staten Island up to Manhattan and Harlem and vice versa. None of that was actually on the table. But these are the kind of rumors that start to circulate in local community meetings and church meetings, and then eventually they get replayed in newspapers, in some cases on television. And so you have people protesting against what they fear might happen as opposed to the very small-scale type of integration proposals that were actually going to be implemented. So whereas a lot of the proposals were to send a few hundred students between schools that were only a few blocks apart, parents are often reacting against plans that they think is eventually going to send thousands and thousands of students miles and miles away. It was very difficult for civil rights activists and proponents of school segregation to fight against those myths because they had such power, because they were based on people's fears about things that might happen in the future. It was very difficult. It was not rational in many ways. It was people arguing and lobbying the worst possible case scenarios that were very unlikely to actually take place.
That's the voice of Matthew Delmont. He is the author of Why Busing Failed, Race, Media, and the National Resistance to School Desegregation. And you are listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is Sasha Lilly. So one of the points that you make in your book, Why Busing Failed, is that focusing just on the white resistance, the white families, is only part of the story. And part of the problem with histories and the way busing is remembered is it just focuses on that. However, it obviously is part of the story. And so I want to ask you a bit about who was involved in opposing busing, i.e. school desegregation in the North, and framed it around this question of busing. Was this a spontaneous movement of families? Was it more coordinated? How do we understand the origins of that resistance?
So the origins of the resistance were, it involved a lot of parents, particularly white mothers, who were concerned about their schools. And I think that's why it resonated so powerfully in the national media, is the cases they were making sounded great, that they were lobbying for neighborhood schools, they're lobbying for their rights as parents and as mothers to have a voice in where their children were going to be sent to school. They often grew out of existing relationships, whether those relationships were through parent-teacher associations, were through churches, were through community organizations. But then they started to sort of stitch themselves together on regional and national levels. And the media actually helped them do this, right? So you had activists in different communities. They could see how people were lobbying against busing in places like New York or places like Chicago. And then when issues would come to their city, they would often pick up much of the same language. So even if they hadn't met these other protesting parents in person, they could see that they were not alone in being concerned or being fearful about what school segregation might mean for their communities. By and large, most of these parents were in neighborhoods that voted Democratic. Most of them probably would have identified as liberal. Almost all of them would have said they're not racist and that they had good relationships with African-Americans and with Puerto Ricans in the Northeast. But what they had was they had the ability and the power to have politicians listen to them when they wanted to protect their schools. So in contrast to African-American parents who were sending their kids to schools that were often underfunded, under-resourced, had fewer experienced teachers, everyone wanted to advocate for their children, right? So you had activist mothers on both sides. The African-American activist mothers didn't have politicians listen to them in the same way that you had the white activist mothers listen to them. I think that's one of the things that it's hard to remember when you see some of this old footage, is that a lot of the things that the white mothers are saying, they intuitively make a lot of sense, that of course they want their children to go to the best schools, and of course they want what's best and most convenient for their children, but African-American parents were saying a lot of the same things, and they just weren't being listened to.
So one part of the story, which we'll get into as we go on, is how the media took up the cause of these white parents, and the story was very much framed around them. To what degree, though, were these white parents, especially white mothers, a very media-friendly image, including the one on the cover of your book, Why Busing Failed, which has a mother holding a little child standing in front of a school bus blocking it. But to what degree was this movement a mass movement?
So it's a funny question, because in some ways it was a mass movement in terms of the amount of attention received. In other ways, it was not a mass movement at all because there weren't that many people involved in it. So starting with the first side is, the parents who were pushing against busing and the politicians who were pushing against it often described it as massive busing. This was particularly a catchphrase that came out in the 1970s. What I was interested to find, though, when I actually started doing the research, is even at its peak, court-ordered busing only applied to just about 5% of school children in the 1970s. So we had this perception that kids were being bused all over the country in the 1970s to desegregate schools, and it's just not true. That there were a handful of corridors in a handful of cities, and those garnered a tremendous amount of media attention. So it was a mass movement in the sense that it received a mass amount of attention. But in terms of who was actually participating, there weren't thousands and thousands and thousands of parents who were actively mobilized to resist busing. But there were key segments of parents in a lot of key cities that were dedicated to the issue, and they were successful in getting people to pay attention to them. So I think one of the best cases is a woman named Irene McCabe, who is from Pontiac, Michigan. She led this somewhat amazing, what she called a mother's march. It was her and five other mothers who marched from Pontiac, Michigan to Washington, D.C., 620 miles, as a way to lobby for a constitutional amendment against busing. She received national news coverage on both television and newspapers for this six-week march that she was doing. So millions and millions of people would have heard about her story. When she actually arrived in Washington, D.C., only about 1,000 people actually showed up to support her rally. Right? So there's a disconnect between how much attention the media paid to these anti-busing protesters and how many anti-busing protesters they were. And I think, unfortunately, for the cause of school desegregation, the few thousand very, very vocal anti-busing protesters came to dominate the national conversation, eventually came to really thwart school desegregation nationally.
Well, this may be a hard question to answer, but in your research of busing, the controversy around it, the mobilizations, and the media coverage, if one can sift out this question from how the media shaped the whole story, do you think that these white families, people like Irene McCabe, were representative of the majority sentiment of, say, working class white parents living in cities, or is that just something that we can't really figure out in hindsight?
I couldn't give you a precise percentage, but I think it is fair to say that they were representative, and I feel comfortable saying that for two reasons. One is that they received thousands of letters from parents all across the country. Right? This is both true of the grassroots activists and the politicians who raised their voices against busing. So we have some sense that even the parents who President Nixon might have called the silent majority, even if they weren't out there marching in the street, they supported the political sentiments that were being advocated by some of the more vocal anti-busing activists. And then secondly, there was not a groundswell of support in favor of school desegregation in the North among white parents. And so I think that's, if there were people who were vehemently opposed to some of the anti-busing activists among white communities, they didn't show up. I think that's one of the challenges for thinking about school segregation in these northern, midwestern, and western cities, is that by and large, the parents who didn't raise their voice in either direction, their perspectives tended to get grouped with the people who were advocating against school segregation, because the default case was if schools were not going to be forcibly desegregated through court orders, they were going to be segregated schools. Right? These were segregated schools often in the suburbs and in many, many cities. If white parents didn't advocate for an opposite direction, for actually desegregating schools, then they were going to end up having segregated schools. If they didn't lobby against that, then Unfortunately they were siding with the people who were opposing busing.
Indeed. What about opposition to desegregating schools and the whole controversy around busing as a stand-in for that by mainstream politicians, Republican and Democrat, on a national scale?
So busing is really one of the few bipartisan issues you find in the 1960s and 70s. So one of the most important things that I found when I was working on this book is the way in which, when the Civil Rights Act is written in 1964, it's written with explicit anti-busing provisions that are included in it, and those are included at the behest of Northern primarily Democratic and liberal senators, because they're reflecting their constituents' fears about school desegregation. So they define desegregation, what the Civil Rights Act is going to be able to achieve, as being it's going to fight against desegregation as it looks in the South, but it's not going to fight against what they called racial imbalance in the North. That's really important because it limits what the federal government can do in terms of uprooting segregation. So it gave the federal government power to go into the South and say, you can't have segregated schools anymore, but at the same time, it directed the attention of federal authorities away from schools in New York, Chicago, and Los Angeles. So that's one way in which politicians, in this case from the Democratic Party, did a lot to maintain segregated schools, and it's not something that we usually call attention to. After the Civil Rights Act in 1964, you have politicians from both parties taking up busing as an issue that they're going to run with. I think one of the reasons you see so much of that is there's very little downside for them to advocate against busing, because there isn't, beyond civil rights activists and beyond the African American community, there isn't a strong pro-busing camp. So there's a one-term governor from Florida named Claude Kirk, who took over the school district in Manatee, Florida, for a period of time and had, again, a period of where he received a tremendous amount of national media attention for his resistance to busing. President Nixon plays the most important role, both in terms of speaking against busing with his national platform, but then also appointing judges who are going to advocate for those kind of policies. But you also see Democratic politicians either advocating explicitly against busing or not taking a stand one way or the other on the issue.
Well, let's talk about a movement on the other side, which is that of the civil rights movement in the North. And the people who, and you've alluded to this earlier in the program, the parents and other people who were involved in trying to dismantle school segregation. What did that movement look like?
So civil rights activism in the North was widespread and dedicated for decades. I think it's one thing that we lose when we just focus on Boston in the 1970s is that in Boston, in New York, in Chicago, all across the country, you have people who have been working on these issues of school segregation, of school equality, for decades before the 1970s. In New York, Kenneth Clark, who's most famous from his Dahl test that got cited in the Brown versus Board decision, and Ella Baker, who's most famous for her grassroots organizing in the South, are two of the key activists who are fighting to organize parents to pressure the school board to do something about school segregation in New York. In Boston, there's a woman named Ruth Batson who organizes parents for decades before the 1970s. So it was really a widespread movement, and they were dedicated, resilient, and resourceful. They were fighting a very, very difficult fight to try to uproot school segregation in the North because the people they were fighting against denied the existence of school segregation. They said, you know, this can't be happening in the North. It can only happen in the South. And so civil rights activists had to keep parents engaged in this activism while also trying to change the terms of the debate and reframe the debate to say, you know, yes, this can be happening in the North, and then try to bring those cases to courts to actually get courts to find that school segregation was in place. Some of the most large-scale protests that take place are in the early 1960s. You have a series of organized school boycotts. New York is the largest, but it also happens in Chicago and in Boston. In the case of New York, over 460,000 students stay out of school in early 1964 to protest against these conditions of educational inequality. And that 460,000 number is important because it's actually the largest civil rights event of the decade, right? So it's much larger than the March on Washington. But it's something that most people aren't aware of. I think one of the reasons people aren't aware of it is that the way in which it was covered by the media at the time, by the New York Times in this case, looked very different than how they chose to cover civil rights in the South. They described that boycott in New York as a case of illegal adult-encouraged truancy. And so it didn't have the same kind of moral backing as the civil rights movement did in the South. The last thing I would say about the civil rights activism in the North is it ends up being largely unsuccessful on the school issue, unfortunately, that they push on these issues for years and years and years and only ever get small scale victories. They, in some cases, are able to force issues to court. They can win those court cases, but by then, the school districts have delayed taking any efforts for so long that that there's been such white flight that schools can't be integrated in meaningful ways. And so by the late 1960s, you start to see a lot of these activists turn their attention more towards community control of schools, and they, in many cases, leave school segregation behind as a goal. But it shouldn't call our attention away from the fact that you had decades of activism pushing for educational equality in the North.
Matthew Delmont is my guest. We'll return with him in just a moment. You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is Sasha Lilly, and today I'm joined by Associate Professor of History at Arizona State University, Matthew Delmont. We are talking about his book, Why Busing Failed: Race, Media, and the National Resistance to School Desegregation. That's published by the University of California Press. He's also the author of The Nicest Kids in Town, American Bandstand, Rock and Roll, and the Struggle for Civil Rights in 1960s Philadelphia. So when one thinks of busing, it's hard not to think of Boston, because that was certainly represented in the media as the flashpoint for what was framed as a crisis around busing in the 1970s. I wonder if you could tell us what Boston schools looked like at the point of court-ordered desegregation in Boston and the emergence of this hot-button issue around busing.
Sure. So by the 1970s, Boston schools have bifurcated along lines of race and class. So you have some schools that are relatively affluent and are getting a fair amount of resources, but then you have a number of other schools that are not getting resources in anything like the same way. And those are primarily African-American schools. And I think the resources here are important. So the issues that civil rights activists were pushing against, it was not so much wanting to have black kids just sit next to white kids, but they saw when they would go into these white schools that the teachers were more experienced, there were fewer substitute teachers, that you had more funding per child, so there would be more current textbooks. You had fewer children in the schools. The school buildings themselves were newer at the white schools. And so these were the issues, these kind of resource-based issues that they were fighting for. Again, that is taking place at least two decades before this crisis develops in Boston. And you have civil rights activists bringing this issue consistently to the Boston School Committee, which was chaired at times by Louise Day Hicks, who becomes a kind of national figure of the white backlash. These civil rights activists are bringing this issue year after year, month after month, but they're consistently refused by Boston school officials, by Boston politicians. And that's the story people usually forget when they start the story of Boston in the 1970s, that the crisis in Boston wasn't just about busing, it was about unconstitutional segregation, that the busing order was put in place because Judge Arthur Garrity found that Boston schools had been intentionally segregated for decades. And that was what the busing order was meant to address. And that period, that intentional segregation, I think one of the concerns I have with how we usually talk about busing is we talk about the feelings and the anger of white communities, right? So the images of how angry South Boston was when busing happened are etched in our brains. But the story in Boston, all these other cities, was about the constitutional rights of black students, right? That's why these busing orders were put in place in the first place. And those busing orders were meant to try to level the playing field and try to get equal resources for African-American students, which they just weren't getting in Boston schools in the 1970s.
Well, following up with that thread, as you say, all of the focus around busing has to do with what has been framed as the white backlash and the narrative of the white backlash. What did busing represent for African Americans in the North and Midwest and West?
So for African American parents and civil rights activists, what they wanted was better educational opportunities for their students. That could look a number of different ways, and so different parents advocate for different things, but better educational opportunities meant that they would receive the same kind of school funding that white schools did, that their teachers would be qualified, that the schools would have the same, that their classes would have the same number of students, that the buildings would be modern, that the textbooks would be modern and not have racist imagery and racist stereotypes in them. These are the things that parents all across the country were advocating for. So it wasn't so much busing wasn't a panacea that they saw as the sort of perfect solution, but it was one tool among many that they thought could improve educational opportunities for their students. And again, it was about resources, not so much about just sitting next to white kids, but they recognized that in almost all of these cities, the resources were disproportionately going to white schools and going away from black schools. I thought, if we can integrate the schools meaningfully, if we can actually get the segregation here, then maybe our kids can go to schools that have these kind of resources. In cases where, so there are a couple avenues that end up pursuing. So one would be the courts. They bring those cases to court as a way to try to force schools, school boards to act. They try all manners of persuasion to get school officials to do something. In some cases, Berkeley and Minneapolis, for example, have somewhat successful voluntary programs of busing, but most school boards were unwilling to do anything unless they were ordered by the court. So the lawsuit route was one that was profitable for African American parents to try to ensure these educational opportunities. The other are these kind of creative programs to independently get their children to better schools. So one of the most famous ones is called Operation Exodus, which took place in Boston, organized by African-American woman named Ellen Jackson and some other parents. And in this case, they used their own resources to rent school buses that would pick up students in African-American neighborhoods and then take them to suburban schools, primarily white schools, a few kids to each school, as a way to improve their educational outcomes. They took advantage of a program called open enrollment that put a huge onus on the parents, but these parents were desperate to do anything they could to improve educational opportunities for their own children. I think it speaks to the resolve of Black parents to find educational opportunities for their students, even if it meant rearranging their work schedules, even meant dedicating resources beyond their tax dollars to transporting their own kids to these suburban schools. These parents were dedicated to doing whatever they could to improve educational opportunities for their students.
Well, let's talk a bit more about Boston, and bearing in mind what you've said, which is the real crisis in Boston was, of course, the extent of school segregation, which gets lost in this picture. But the opponents of desegregating schools, the opponents of busing, framed the conflict at the time as one of crisis. And I wonder if you could talk a bit more about how that notion of crisis was used.
So I think a lot of what we understand about that idea of crisis with regards to busing has a lot to do with how it was covered by the television media. So it's not to say that busing was not violent in Boston. It in some cases was. It's not to say that it was not a very hot-button political issue. It certainly was. But the way in which once television stations decided to cover Boston, in some cases they never left. So what's interesting when you go back and watch the television footage from this era is you would have the stations, ABC, NBC, CBS, reporting when something violent happened, right? So when you had white protesters throwing bricks at school buses. But they were also reporting even when nothing happened. So if there was a quiet day at Boston schools, Walter Cronkite would come on the news and say, this is month two of the Boston busing crisis, and today was quiet, right? And so it would be a recurring storyline, even when there was no new news to report from the situation. And I think that idea of crisis, it shifted the attention away from what was really at stake. So again, the footage of this almost comes to look a lot like footage from the Vietnam War. So you have periods where they're just showing uninterrupted minute-long clips of the police or the National Guard coming in to try to break up white crowds of demonstrators, police riding on horseback, arresting people. And it's very easy to watch that footage and have no idea why these people are protesting in the first place. You entirely lose sight of the fact that this was about Black students and their constitutional rights. What you end up focusing on is the fact that, you know, this was a huge protest going on, and you had to bring in both state and national authorities, police, National Guard, to try to quell these protests. And I think that's the, when we think about the crisis shifts it into something that's more of a media construction than a legal issue or a moral issue about education.
Well, let's talk about the media then. So there's a perception that the U.S. media gave voice to the Southern Civil Rights Movement, bringing into American homes the terrible images of white Southerners and police attacking Black protesters. Number one, is that an accurate view of how the media did cover the Southern Civil Rights Movement? And if so, why does it differ so much from the coverage of school desegregation in the North?
Yeah, so the relationship between the national news media and the Southern Civil Rights Movement, absolutely. It played a critical role in bringing Southern Civil Rights to national audiences, in both TV producers, newspaper reporters, and civil rights activists themselves attest to that. So almost everyone agrees that it's one of the great victory stories for the U.S. news media, is the way in which they covered civil rights in the South and the way in which they really forced Americans to pay attention to what was going on in Alabama and Mississippi. So I think that's absolutely true. What you find when you shift your attention to the North is that the story looks very different, and it looks very different for two reasons. One, the mechanisms of racism and discrimination in the North were much more subtle than they were in the South. So you don't have the same kind of fire hoses, police dogs, police with billy clubs beating peaceful protesters in the North as you do in the South. That the mechanisms of discrimination in the North were often about where do you draw school zoning lines, who can get a mortgage loan in which neighborhood. Those things don't resonate visually in quite the same way. They don't get conveyed in the media in the same way, because these are aspects of discrimination that were taking place over decades, and they took a long time to form, and the media just doesn't pick up on them the same way. The second reason it's covered differently in the North is that most of the national news media is based in the North, so they're based in New York or in D.C. or in Chicago, and they're much more timid about covering issues in their own cities than they were in the South. I think this has to do with their lack of understanding of what civil rights or racism looked like in the North, so they just fundamentally couldn't believe that this could be a Northern issue, that it could only exist in Alabama, Mississippi, it couldn't exist in Massachusetts or New York. But then also they were worried about offending their viewers outside of the South. So it was in some ways easier to point to the South and say, this is the backwards region of the United States where racism still exists. It was much more difficult to look at Chicago or look at New York and say, these places that we consider liberal are actually deeply racist in how they're constructing their school policies or how they have their housing policies constructed. That's a difficult thing for the media to convey, and they were very timid in terms of how they presented this issue to their audiences.
In the ways that the media covered school desegregation in the North and the backlash against busing, was that something that was particularly specific to television, or would you say that that was really across the board, print media and so on?
So I think the big difference between the television and newspaper coverage in this area is television becomes the dominant national news form. I think that's important for two reasons. There's one, they're reaching national audiences, millions and millions of viewers, in a way that newspapers can't. And also, they don't have the same kind of local connections that newspapers do. So I think, to generalize, newspapers had the opportunity to provide better coverage of these issues because they had dedicated education reporters who were in cities, and they could follow the stories. They knew the people on the ground who were the key players in the stories. And they at least had the opportunity to provide more kind of fleshed out coverage to the issues. They also had more space to do so in terms of the length of their stories and how they could revisit a story. Television news was really, what's interesting about television news and how it covered the issue is that they had to make decisions about how they allocated their camera teams, right? And so one thing that hadn't really occurred to me until I got into this research is if they're going to cover a protest in Pontiac, they have to know in advance that protest is taking place. And so it's one of the things, and this is true of Boston as well, it's one of the reasons Boston gets so much coverage, is once a place gets identified as a site of conflict or a site where a story is going to develop, then the television camera crews can be dispatched in advance to those locations, and they can report on something, whether there's an interesting story coming from there or not. That has a lot to do, that ends up shaping how these issues get understood, right? If television is interested in things that make for good visual stories, they're drawn to these large-scale mass protests against busing, but they want to know that if they're going to dedicate a camera crew to go there, that's going to be a good story to come of it. So once busing got established as a consistent storyline, it's almost like a perpetuating cycle, that once television got interested in busing, it got more interested in busing because they knew that this was something that they could send a camera team there, they could get good footage from Pontiac or from Chicago or Boston and make for a compelling story from it. What was difficult, though, is that television didn't have any local connections here. So you had, and they would have television reporters interviews from them where they describe this kind of context. They describe it as you parachute into a city, try to quickly get up to speed on what's going on there, and then do a 2-minute or 3-minute segment on that story. These stories about school segregation were incredibly complex, and so part of it isn't about blaming television news. It's just a kind of a structural limitation of that media form, but they continued to report on these issues in a way that would be visually interesting to their audiences, and that meant that they were drawn to people who had very clear talking points and very clear sound bites, and those were the anti-busing activists. But it had a lot to do with, it ended up shaping how the conversation about school segregation developed, because the pro-busing side was more complex in terms of their sound bites. They couldn't speak quite the same way to the television media, but also they weren't visually attractive in the same way that the anti-busing forces were.
Historian Matthew Del Monte is my guest. We're talking about his book, Why Busing Failed, Race, Media, and the National Resistance to School Desegregation, published by UC Press. You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, and I'm Sasha Lilly. One of the interesting things, though, in thinking about how media coverage differed from the coverage of the Southern Civil Rights Movement and then the Civil Rights Movement in the North, is that one thing that shifted was that the anti-busing protesters harnessed some of the rhetoric that the Southern Civil Rights Movement had used and used it against the Northern Civil Rights Movement.
Absolutely. So the people who ended up being opposed to school segregation, these anti-busing activists in the North, were very careful students of the Civil Rights Movement. So they watched people like Martin Luther King lead these marches, and they purposely constructed their marches and their talking points in a very similar way. So a couple things to highlight is the people who were advocating against school segregation in cities like New York or Pontiac, they would say, this is our civil rights movement. These are our civil rights, and we're fighting for them. They would never say, we don't want our children to be sent to school with black students, or we don't want black students to be sent to our neighborhood schools. They would say, these are our civil rights. These are our rights as parents. So taking up the exact same language that civil rights activists had used just a few years earlier. But then also, they were very keenly aware of how to structure their protests. So they would have lots of protests with women and children foregrounded with American flags, with clearly marked signs, a lot of the same kind of techniques and tactics that the civil rights movement used, including protest marches that echoed back to key civil rights moments. So Irene McCabe, who I mentioned, led a mother's march to Washington, right? Again, a purposeful echo of the 1963 march on Washington, but for a very different purpose, right? She's trying to lobby for a constitutional amendment to block busing, but she takes on the language of the mother who's doing this on behalf of her children's rights and is going on this sort of brave, sacrificial journey to fight for her rights as an American citizen.
You've been describing in this hour how you had valiant African-American parents trying to desegregate the schools of the North. You had this pushback by white parents who were backed by national politicians and backed by the media. And in the telling of the histories of the civil rights movement, we are told this is the end. This was the end of the civil rights movement. It ran up against busing in the North. I wonder if you could tell us your assessment of what busing represented in that larger picture and the fate of this question of school segregation.
I think in our larger understanding of civil rights, I think busing is useful in a couple ways. The first is we still have a perception that civil rights moved north in some way, that it wasn't until Martin Luther King started coming to Chicago in the mid-60s that the civil rights movement moved north, and that's definitely not true. You had dedicated civil rights activists, a fully formed civil rights movement in the North, in the Midwest, in the West, before Martin Luther King or Southern activists came there. But at the same time, you had dedicated resistance to civil rights also in the North, long before Martin Luther King got there. And I think if we think about civil rights in a national context, we can appreciate the fact that this was both a national movement for African-American civil rights, but also that there was resistance at a national level, right? So we, as a nation, I think we like to look to the Southern movement and find all the things that are good about our country or sort of good about our better nature. But when you look to cities like Boston, Chicago, or New York, and the way in which white parents and politicians resisted issues like school segregation or housing integration, you can see that support for civil rights was thin, right? The support that the nation gave, particularly white citizens gave to civil rights, was okay if it was taking place in the South, but it was not okay if it was taking place in their own city or in their own neighborhood. Right? I think busing helped to expose that the limitation of support for civil rights, that support for civil rights was never as widespread as we would like to believe among white citizens, that it was something that there was a lot of support for when it was in the South, in Mississippi, Alabama, a lot less support for when it was coming to California or Massachusetts.
Sure. And then what happened with the cause of school desegregation from the mid-70s onward?
So it continues. After Boston in 1974, you have a number of school districts who are brought into court, and the courts find that the schools have intentionally segregated their school systems against the Constitution, against the 14th Amendment. And you have court-ordered busing put in place in a number of schools all across the country. And these take place with less fanfare. In some cities, they work better than in other cities. But you have parents never stopped fighting to get better educational opportunities for their students. So busing, in some ways, has more periods of success in the late 1970s and 1980s, once it can take place more at a local level outside of the national media's attention. But there's, at the same time, you have more parents with means moving to suburbs and dedicating their resources to building schools that are largely segregated in the suburbs, and that's where their resources are going to be. So you have a bifurcation of city school districts and suburban school districts. And after the Supreme Court's Milliken decision in Detroit in 1974, it becomes impossible to have school segregation plans that cross over between city and suburban school districts, and that really limits the potential for closing this resource gap.
So then, if you were to do an assessment now of the degree to which American schools, especially in the areas that we've been talking about in the North and the Midwest, the West, are still segregated, how would you assess that?
Well, the demographic reports that come out, and UCLA's Center for Civil Rights does a report annually about the level of national school segregation, and these consistently find that a lot of these large northern school districts are as segregated, or in some cases more segregated, than they were in the 1960s. And this is disheartening for people who care about these issues, but I think a lesson we can learn from the history is trying to understand why school segregation, why court orders didn't lead to more full school segregation in the 1960s and 70s. And I think if we can understand the kind of resistance that they faced and the kind of limitations that were placed by politicians in the Civil Rights Act and the legislation about what was even possible, when we look at the contemporary landscape, my hope is that we can better understand what tactics might work now to improve both racial and socioeconomic integration of schools, and then where that kind of integration is impossible, lobby for the kind of resource reallocation that would bring more qualified teachers, more textbooks, more smaller class sizes to schools where they're most needed.
Well, I do, of course, realize you're a historian, but I wonder if you could expand a bit on those lessons that could be drawn from the past. What do you think, or what is indicated to you about what avenues might work to desegregate schools and which ones might be trickier?
Yeah, I think a lesson we can learn from the history is that parents and school officials who care about these issues have to fight for them. I think that's something that's clear from looking at the history, that it was too easy for people who were on the fence to not take a position on either side. But what we need is, if people care about school integration, whether it's by race or by socioeconomic class, you have to voice those opinions and stick to those commitments. We're in a trickier place now after the Supreme Court's parents' choice decision in Seattle in the late 2000s really limited what can be done in terms of race. So I think there's probably more pragmatic avenues to take right now in terms of integration based on class or integration based on socioeconomic status. But I think for those to be successful, I think you have to confront people's parents' fears and concerns about what those kind of decisions might mean for their children. Right? I think that's one thing that people didn't do enough of the first time around. It was too easy for parents' fears to dominate the conversation in a negative way. But if we recognize that changing the status quo, recognizing two things: one, that the status quo of education is not going to work for our civic life and for our country going forward. But to change it, that's going to be scary to a lot of people, and particularly it's going to be scary to a lot of people who like their educational opportunities now. I think trying to address those issues head on and recognize that a case has to be made why there's a moral case and a civic case for educational equality, and how decisions can be made to produce better outcomes. That has to be almost like a public relations campaign. That has to be repeatedly stated and repeatedly advocated for on a consistent basis by people who have the authority and the power to advocate for it. And I think that's important because the system we have right now didn't come about naturally. Right? I think that's one of the limitations we have when we think about this idea of de facto segregation, that nothing about the segregation we have in the present moment is natural. It was a series of decisions that took place all across the country by parents, by politicians, for years and years and years. To undo that, we have to make a different set of decisions. And I think we need a commitment and a vocal commitment to take our educational system with regards to school segregation in a different direction.
Well, given that so many Americans live in neighborhoods that are still racially segregated, do you think that in addressing school segregation, that having buses which will allow children to get to schools that are not in their neighborhoods, whether it's based on class or, you know, some other rubric, that is a necessary part of addressing school segregation now?
I think so. I think this will look different in different cities. I mean, in some cases, you can redraw zoning lines in a way that will produce different kind of school demographics. In some cases, there would be transportation involved, whether it's by public transportation or by school buses. But I think doing something is essential, and recognizing the way in which previous attempts to address these issues were undercut before they were even given a real chance is crucial to charting a better future with this.
Matthew Delmont, I want to thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much for talking to me.
I've been speaking with the author of Why Busing Failed, Race, Media, and the National Resistance to School Desegregation. That's published by the University of California Press. You can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. Matthew Delmont teaches history at Arizona State University and is also the author of The Nicest Kids in Town, American Bandstand, Rock and Roll, and the Struggle for Civil Rights in 1960s Philadelphia. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.